clear of the doors. Por favor, manténganse alejado de las puertas.
We welcome you aboard our Highway of Guide.
If you're standing, please hold on to the handrails and stay clear of the automatic doors. They will be closing in a moment. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Monorail Tales. Sitting by my side, or I should say opposite me, is Steve. So are you ready for a fun evening, Steve?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we got a good night ahead of us. Our guest for tonight started his Disney journey back in the spring of 1972 as a young boy with his first trip to Walt Disney World with his parents, and eventually ending up in his adult life working for Disney. And even though he is no longer working at the Magic Kingdom, believe me when I say he is still surrounded with Disney magic in his hometown in New Jersey. And we will get to hear about that magic. If not this episode, hopefully next episode. But anyway, let's get on with this show. And it's my great pleasure now to introduce our special guest for this evening, Randy Senna. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Welcome. Hi, folks. How you all doing?
Hey, yeah. So good to hear you, Randy.
Yes, absolutely. I'm up here in sunshiny New Jersey, and it was a very beautiful day. Unseasonably, it was almost 75 degrees up here today. Oh. Can you imagine?
Wow. Well, we just got rain starting here in South Carolina.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we were at, and down here, we were at 80.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Now, I say New Jersey. What is the town, Randy, that you actually live in?
Currently, I'm in Wildwood, New Jersey. We are at the furthest bottom part of the state. If you go a little further, you have Cape May. And if you go beyond that, you fall into the Delaware Bay. So, I mean, you can't get too much further down. I've been from New Jersey pretty much all my life, with the exception, of course, during the period that I worked for Disney. But I was born in North Jersey in West Orange and was raised in Short Hills. And most of my time was up in North Jersey. And then we lived in Central Jersey, and now I'm down in South Jersey.
All right, since we're talking Jersey, I might as well say I lived in North Bergen.
Wow, sure, that's pretty far up. That's north.
Yeah, we were right on the Hudson.
Wow, right across from New York, huh?
Yep, looking right across.
My only North Bergen story is a lady that used to play at one of my games on the boardwalk when I operated in Seaside, and her name was Grace, and she was an older lady, and she looked really tough with a boyish bob haircut. And I remember there was the incident with the Iraq attack that was going on, and everybody was worried about the Iraq war. And Grace walked in one day, and I announced her on the microphone, "Here comes General Grace Foley," who just came back from a tour in Iraq. And she's looking at me, and she's like not knowing what to say, and she kind of looked like she could be a general. And everybody applauded her. And she wasn't a general. She wasn't in the army. I mean, her. I think family owned a fish store in North Bergen. So, so that's whenever I think of North Bergen, I think of Grace the Fish Lady.
Well, I'm not associated with New Jersey, except, you know, one of our co-hosts, and now you, Randy. So, yes.
I don't know. You have a New Jersey accent.
Yes, she does.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, everybody else thought it was what, British?
I think I confuse some people because, you know, they think I do have a Southern accent when I go to Disney, and that really just throws them. So,
well, I'm not getting Southern unless it's Southern United Kingdom. Where are you from?
Actually, I was born near London, but I moved around quite a bit, actually, because my dad was in the Royal Marines. But we actually ended up on the West Coast before I emigrated to Canada.
Yeah.
Oh, so, wow. So you went to Canada first. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm
you brought a little of that United Kingdom accent with you. You'd fit right in at the UK Pavilion at Epcot.
Hey, I'll tell you, it's really weird, actually, Randy, because I've been this side of the world longer than I have been in England. And you would think by now I would have picked up an accent, you know, or lost an accent.
You know, your ear gets trained when you're young. You know, people say that I have a, you know, New York type of accent. And particularly, I remember, you know, meeting people in Disney World who said, oh, you're from New York. I go, no, I'm from Jersey.
Love it.
Right, exactly.
New Yorkers say Jersey, you know. New Jersey people say Jersey.
Yeah.
See, I love the accents here in America.
You know, people when they spoke properly, the accents were quite delightful. But today, I don't think a lot of people know how to speak the proper English language, even the American English. So it gets all messed up and. It's not the same as it once was. What is the same as it once was? The whole world has changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, when we spoke the other day, I did say chances are we're going to go off track, and we've already done that already.
Yay. Well, that's all right. It's a little bit of you know, foundation for your viewers to understand, you know, who you're speaking with. And, you know, then they can take it from there because, you know, people who go to Disney come from all parts of the world. And mainly it started out with most people going to Walt Disney World were domestic. We're from America. Today it's become quite international, has been for many decades already. But in the beginning, you didn't see many international guests at Walt Disney World. You saw Americans. And it was unusual when you saw the Asian family walking by or, you know, the British or even the Brazilians with the tourism shirts that used to infiltrate during the summers and come, you know, with a whole line of people wearing the same color shirt from Stella Barbados tours and all these good things like that. You know, it became a melting pot, very international. But in the beginning, it wasn't so much that way.
That time period where you started getting invaded by the Brits and, you know, all other countries coming in, what was that like for the guests at Disney? Was there a feeling of, you know, that you were being invaded?
Well, it was a slow growth. For those of us who went religiously every year, you didn't notice it like they opened the tidal wave gate or anything of this nature. But it was definitely noticeable, particularly when you started getting the Asian groups come in, because you can physically see that these people are from another country. You know, when the Brits are there, you can't tell who's really British unless they start speaking with the Cockney accent.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a reverse version of that when I went to the Orient and I went to Shanghai. I saw that. It was like, oh, you know, tall blonde guy, that's different. Standing in line with all of us. So yeah, I got the stares quite a bit when I was there.
Well, you were very special. You know, over in the Orient, blonde-haired gentlemen who are tall are a delicacy. I had a friend who worked with me at Disney, and he was very, very light-skinned blonde and a very good-looking young man. And when he went to Japan, he was very, very specially treated like a god because he was that different.
Yeah. I wasn't exactly treated like a god, but...
That's because he's ugly, though.
Oh, is that it? Yeah, might be.
I mean, this young man used to do Chippendales. I mean, so he was treated like a god.
Nice. All right. I can understand that.
And unfortunately, the only Chippendales I know is Rescue Rangers, so...
Well, the only Chippendales I know are the ones walking around the park, but I mean...
Exactly.
I remember when he told me he was a Chippendale dancer, I couldn't believe him. I was like, you know, who would do this? But I mean, hey.
Yep. I would if I could.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was going back like 40 years ago that, you know, he first told me about it. It wasn't as accepted, shall we say, as today, you know, where, you know, anything goes. But when you think Chippendales, you're thinking of naked people dancing, you know, on a bar with a bunch of, you know, middle-aged women holding dollars. So, I mean, Exactly the image that you think, but hey, what it is.
You should see Sheila's smile.
I'm looking for the dollars.
I bet they're Disney bucks.
Yeah. Hold on, Sheila. No coins. No coins.
No coin. No coin. Disney dollars only.
Oh my gosh, you guys. So, Randy, okay, let's I've got to ask you. I do have to start. When you first went to Disney, how old were you?
I was 11 years old.
11 years old. Okay.
It was the spring of 72, and everybody, you know, who's a Disney follower should know that Walt Disney World opened October 1st, 1971. So to have been there in the spring of 72, it was really at the very, very beginning. It was only a few months after the park had actually opened.
Now, where did you stay on that trip?
You know, back then, it's hard for, you know, people to imagine today, but back then there were only two options. If you were staying at Walt Disney World, you stayed at the Polynesian or the Contemporary Resort. And for us, it was the Contemporary. And I'm very glad it was, because it became our home away from home, the Contemporary Resort Hotel, the magnificent A-frame structure. And there was not even a golf resort at that time. And to stay off property really wasn't an option, because you went to Disney World, you were going to a destination, you were going far away. You really didn't know what you were going to at that time. People were not accustomed to it, to have a familiarity with these surrounding areas. So although there were some hotels in Kissimmee on 192, they were not even that prevalent. So you stayed on property, and that's simply the way it was. And I'm very glad that it was that way, because it was a magnificent experience for everybody who stayed at these hotels. And they weren't really, really that expensive. I remember when we stayed at the Contemporary, we stayed in the Towers, and I believe it was about $45 a night. If you stayed in the Wings, I think it was $38. Now, money was different. Of course, you're talking, 1972, you're talking 50 years ago, but it was very, very affordable back then. Maybe a regular hotel room someplace else might have been $20. But you're talking, it was double. It was a little bit more than double. But you were staying in Walt Disney World, very, very special, brand new hotel, deluxe accommodations. You couldn't get that experience anyplace else.
No. And it was, like you just said, it was a one of a kind, and actually still is. It is the only hotel in the world that has a monorail that runs through it.
Well, the monorail certainly makes everything very, very special with the Contemporary. Not that the Contemporary isn't nice anyway, but that monorail running right through the Grand Canyon Concourse lobby is an absolute thing that brings the hotel to life. When that monorail whisks through, you actually feel vibration of the monorail going through the building. And you feel that even up at the guest rooms if you're staying in the Towers. And, you know it. And what was even more special was when they had the original monorail, and when they would open the doors and they would push the buttons, and you would hear that really not perfectly synchronized clicking of all the doors opening. Somehow or another, they never all clicked exactly at the same time. So you heard a bunch of clicks, like within a split second, but you'd hear all the clicks come from the doors, and they would pop open. And sometimes one of the doors wouldn't come open, and the attendants were on the platform there to open the doors. And then, of course, after everybody was loaded in, you heard slam, 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 as the attendants would go down slamming each and every door of the monorail. And that sound echoed through the Contemporary right up to the guest rooms way up high. So it was actually part of the atmosphere. It gave it life, which was really quite amazing. And then, of course, you added that with the traditional mariachi band that would be playing quite often on the fourth floor, and they would oftentimes stand on the monorail platform and play and fill the entire Grand Canyon concourse with the echoing sound of their Spanish songs being played. And they would usually have some vocalist singing as he played the violin in Spanish. And it was very festive. It was the festive atmosphere, almost like the Three Caballeros. And that's the way the Contemporary was. It was a festive hotel. They had the orange theme with the hotel. The phone book in the hotel room was, you know, in a jacket that was orange. Orange trees, you know, decorated with yellow and little lights made of plastic on the fourth floor. The orange and silver lights that outlined the guest rooms as you look up, up to the 15th floor. Of course, you're only seeing up to 12 from the fourth floor, because then there is no 13th, and then the 14th is the suites areas, and then the 15th is top of the world. But, you know, each room hallway was outlined and trimmed with the orange and silver light bars that lit up the whole hotel as a festive atmosphere. And that was the theme. The theme was festivity, including down at the first floor with the game room. It was the Fiesta Fun Center. And they had, you know, the images of the three caballeros, who were the symbol of the Fiesta Fun Center, because it was a hotel of festivities and fun. And it really was. It was that. It changed. That changed in the mid-80s, where they wanted to become more highfalutin and upscale, turn your nose up in the air and a little bit snobby. And the mariachi guys, you know, disappeared and were replaced with a cocktail lounge piano player playing outside of the outer rim downstairs on the fourth floor, tinkling away at the piano. And it was nice, but it's not a festive feeling when you're hearing the ritzy piano player playing, to fill the air with that music. So it's different. It's not that I don't like the contemporary anymore. Of course, I will always love the contemporary. It's home away from home for me. But it's not the same as it was when it started with the festive atmosphere of the contemporary. And the entire mosaic with the center core where the elevators are at the Grand Canyon, with the Mary Blair type of atmosphere tiles that were created, is a Southwestern type of theme going along with that Mexican type of atmospheric fiesta that goes along with the hotel. Even all the pictures that were on the walls in the lobbies and in the hotel rooms themselves had that same small worldy look, Mary Blair, festive, Midwestern, Southwestern type of, you know, kid characters in it. So it was very well themed right along the way.
I'm sitting here in awe, Randy, because you have just painted the most fantastic picture I have ever heard.
Yeah.
Of the contemporary.
And the contemporary will always be a special place. I mean, I'm not a fan of what they did to the North Wings, building the Bay Lake Towers. I get the push with the timeshare, but the architecture simply doesn't fit with the contemporary. That magnificent A-frame that came up out of nowhere and stood, you know, by itself. It has now a curved structure, really what looks like within inches of the building. Of course, it's a little bit of an illusion. It's not that close, but it's pretty close that it's right there on the one side. And I don't think they did any justice to the architecture of the contemporary when they built the Bay Lake Towers. Also, they destroyed the North Wings in order to do that. There's so much property at Walt Disney World. I question the wisdom sometimes of things they do and their planning. But, you know, Disney is still so wonderful that we always accept everything they do. And some people are not exactly happy with them, but we always accept them because we still love going to Disney World. But sometimes I feel that the planners don't have the same love. They don't have the same experience as the guests who live the experience. So when they make the decisions and they do these projects, sometimes there's something lacking because they just don't know. You have to live the dreams in order to create them and to build upon them. And if you don't have that experience and you can't have somebody explain it to you well enough so that you understand it, then you have things that are disconnected. And this is one of the examples of it.
You know, the whole idea of the word contemporary, I think over the past 50 years, may have gotten a little bit construed, even from the way you're telling the story. I think we think contemporary is like, oh, up to date, up to, you know, whatever is going on right now. But I don't think that really applies to that building, does it? Or should
it? Well, it was the idea for it to be a very ultra-modern hotel when they built it. It was modularly built, which was a unique feature when they did that, where they actually built the rooms separately, almost like you would build a mobile home. And the rooms arrived on trucks. They were raised up via cables of a crane, and they were slid into the frame mm-hmm. of the structure itself, so that it was a modular constructed hotel. The thinking behind that was that as the rooms wore out, you could slide one out, like out of a drawer, and put a new one in. Of course, that wouldn't be realistic because you would have to have cranes there pulling them out and doing that when you can just, you know, update them when they're there. But that's the way it was constructed, and it was supposed to be an ultra-modern hotel. But you know what? They kind of, you know, I would think you would have learned from Tomorrowland and the Magic Kingdom. The same thing when you build Epcot. When you build something that is cutting edge for the future is a moving target. It's always changing. So by the time you build the future is no longer what it was when you started building it. It's never going to be something that will stay the same. So you can build a whimsical view of the future, and hopefully, you know, the future won't tarnish it too much when it becomes a reality. I mean, I think back to the Jetsons. It's still pretty timeless, but the Jetsons back when we were kids watching that in the 60s, that was very futuristic. And we thought we were going to be flying around in the bubble miniature flying saucers. But it really hasn't happened that way, has it? So I don't know if it ever will, but it's still nice to think of it that way. But when you try to build for the future that's not too far away, it has a way of catching up on you.
Yeah, and I do like that. I was just thinking the same thing about Tomorrowland is kind of the same way. It just can't keep up with what it's labeled as.
I don't know if you should try to keep up. You know, tomorrow is always going to be different. And Tomorrowland is one of those lands that probably is one that should have updates made to it. I remember when I first went to Walt Disney World, it was Flight to the Moon. As a matter of fact, when I first went, Tomorrowland was almost nothing. It almost didn't exist. I believe the Monsanto America the Beautiful was there and probably Flight to the Moon. But that was it. That was Tomorrowland. There was no, Star Jet rocket ride. There were no people movers going around. Carousel of Progress didn't exist. Certainly Space Mountain didn't exist. So I believe on the guidebooks, the Grand Prix Raceway was the only other attraction in Tomorrowland. And then if you had Wings opened, it was presented by Eastern Airlines. That was a big deal. And it was like, wow, a new ride coming to Tomorrowland. And it was a free attraction. It was complimentary, which you have to remember back in the beginning, rides all had A, B, C, D, or E tickets. And each time you went on the ride, you had to present a ticket. So the if you had Wings was presented for free by Eastern Airlines. And it was very popular because of that. And it had the Omni Mover, which people like, and the line kept going through. And it was, a nice addition. But, of course, you know, in time, that was changed to Delta Dream Flight, and now you have the Toy Story. Do these changes enhance things? I don't know. The ride really didn't change much when it went from If You Had Wings to Delta Dream Flight. It was still the same type of thing. They changed inside. They changed the song. But for those who grew up with If You Had Wings, you ride through it, you're still singing, If You Had Wings, had
yes,
wings,
had I've been wings, singing it ever since wings. You said it.
You could go anywhere if you had wings. You could do anything if you had wings. I mean, it's indoctrinated in your brain.
Yes.
It's just the way it is. America the Beautiful became the magic carpet around the world. That changed also. And they updated the film a little bit. And then Flight to the Moon became Mission to Mars because, going to the moon became not futuristic enough because, of course, we went to the moon. Get me started with that because I don't believe anybody went to the moon. I'm one of those moon conspiracy people. We didn't go to any moon 1969. Get out of here. I knew it was a fraud then. But so you might as well go to Mars, because at least maybe that is in the future. But, you know, when people say, you know, how we went to the moon, I say, just like, you know, flight to the moon in Tomorrowland. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, you know, and McDonnell Douglas right. presenting flight to the moon. So as a matter of fact, those were the first words that I spoke on a Disney microphone, was at flight to the moon.
Really?
That's right. I was a kid. And I was standing there at the pre-show where they showed the NASA console there, and the animatronics were there. And the host, of course, was Mr. Johnson. And the host, who I remember was a young Asian man, he was standing ready to have his interaction with the audio animatronic show. And I was standing right there, front row, first one right by him. He was standing on a little platform, so I was by his feet. So at one point, he leaned down to me. He said, say thank you, Mr. Johnson. And he held the microphone to my mouth when it was time to say thank you, Mr. Johnson, to the response of Mr. Johnson and his little show and his presentation. And when my voice came over the microphone, everybody turned and they looked, and it was me. And it wasn't like a little kid doing it. I did it professionally. So it was very, very special for me. And that was a memory that was made for me by a very special cast member. And cast members back then were extraordinary. They were really special, special hand-selected people that were beyond the imagination of what people who go to Walt Disney World now can fathom. Because it's not the same. You have special people working there still, but not to the level as was in the beginning.
What was it that made the cast members so special then? Compared
well,
to maybe now?
You understand, the park was not a massive 43-acre encompassing experience of Walt Disney World. Right. Walt Disney World was the Magic Kingdom, the Contemporary, and the Polynesian. That yes. was Walt Disney World. I believe Fort Wilderness had just opened also in a limited you know, aspect. Yes. So you didn't have that many positions that you had to fill. Now, granted, the area didn't have as large a population as it does today. But you were able to be very selective in the people who you hired. And the term cast member came about because you weren't being hired to do a job. You were being cast to play a role in the living show of Walt Disney World. You were playing a part. You were selected. You were cast just like going to an audition for a play or a movie. And through that thinking, they used that aspect of appearance and articulate presentation, intelligence levels, and they selected people and placed them in roles based upon what they would fit properly. They had very, very stringent height-weight guidelines that you really had to be very, very thin to work there, almost pencil skinny in most instances. Wow. So automatically now you had a youthful market because they're going to fit the categories best. You were usually very good looking, usually a wholesome look with the apple pie face, and they didn't allow facial hair, and you had to have short haircuts. So the young men who were typically college age were very, very youthful looking college age. So you had like adult children running the park in very, very roles of responsibility. Driving monorails and steamboats and ferry boats and all these things. You literally had the youth running that. So through the aspect of the selectiveness of what Walt Disney went through painstakingly in order to hire those cast members, he created Utopia. It was an artificial world, indeed. But it wasn't supposed to be the real world. It was Walt Disney World. It was a magic place where you were going to escape the real world. So you came to a perfect place, and the experience was supposed to be as close to perfect as it can be. There's always going to be things that can come up, but hopefully there's going to be enough wonderfulness that you won't even notice them. So everything was to that level. The cast members were the utopians within Utopia.
Right.
Most of them didn't even know it at the time. They didn't know how selective they were with their hiring. But you got that feeling as a guest when you went there that you were in a place that you got an experience you couldn't get anywhere else in the world. And you really couldn't because it was very selective. Was it fair in hiring practices? Probably not. When I started working there, I'm a large framed guy. I'm not enormous, but I am not a skinny kid. So my height weight was higher than their guidelines. So I remember when I left the casting office and I was being given the job, I had a month before my orientation. And I was told that I had to lose 10 pounds to fit in their height weight guidelines.
Wow.
Now, I'm 6'1", and I had to drop to 190 pounds. That's pretty skinny for a guy who's 6'1".
Yeah, so, I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was 200. So okay. When I left, from the moment I left that casting office, I ate nothing. I went on an instant starvation diet. I don't think I even drank water the first couple of days. For 1 month, I ate nothing. I started after the second week of drinking just water, mixing a little orange juice in with the water. And I think just the last week or so, I had a half a piece of Swiss cheese along with my diluted orange juice water up until the time of my orientation when I would be weighed in. And of course, without a doubt, I lost that 10 pounds. But when I tell that story to cast members today, they look at me in disbelief and they say, "You starved yourself for a job?" They would push their face up. And I would look at them and I'd say, I was not applying for a job. I was being hired as a cast member at Walt Disney World. Wow. I was being one of the selected few. I was going to be someone very, very special. They don't seem to have that same understanding. I don't think there's even one that I have spoken to in the last 30 years that would ever have starved themselves in order to work at Walt Disney World. For me, it was without even a thought.
What made you want to work for Disney?
You have to go back to basically my childhood. I was quite an abused child in school. I was different. I was not going to fit in with the different groups. I wasn't the sports kid who constantly played football and baseball, even in grammar school. I wasn't going to hang out with the punks and things of this nature. I was different, and I was always intelligent. And there was a resentment for me amongst my class members, and I was quite shunned, and I was quite bullied. And that started from kindergarten on. So my childhood life was not a happy one, particularly in school. Now, my happy times, of course, were at home. My parents overindulged me and my sister, who they did everything in the world for. And we went to the amusement parks, mostly the Jersey Shore at that time. And I have an extremely tight feeling for the Jersey Shore and the games, because I played games. My parents gave us to play games in the arcades, and the games were my friends. They were my surrogate friends for the kids who were not my friends in school. So that was an escape. But when you went to Walt Disney World, suddenly you were special because you were a guest, and everybody treated you like family. And you were in a place where everybody was happy, everybody was nice to you, and it was utopia. So who wouldn't fall in love with a place which was like heaven for a child who was abused daily in school?
Wow.
So the cast members themselves were the living part of Walt Disney World. They were living the dream. They were there living it. We were only guests, but they were there every day. an amazing thing. And every one of them was nice and went out of their way to be nice to you. And genuinely, not like they had to, or, you know, it was part of their job. It was genuine because they were living the time of their lives as cast members at Walt Disney World. It wasn't a job. They were blessed and privileged with something that they carried with them for their entire life. I don't know anybody who worked at Walt Disney World, especially in the earlier years, who doesn't carry that with them still to this day. And there are groups on Facebook, even for people who worked there in the 70s and the 80s, and we're talking 50 years ago, and they are still the same youth who worked there then because they were implanted with that magic, that pixie dust, as you like to call. They were given a tremendous gift. And they carried that, in most instances, to all corners of the world, sharing that gift through their actions and their ways, each in their own way, different from another, but they carried it with them. And in the real world, when you tell somebody that you worked at Walt Disney World, the ears would light up because you were the admiration of the world. We were. I can't say that today, but it certainly was true in the first two decades.
Right. So basically at 11 years old, I guess you knew all along that you were going to be a cast member then?
Well, actually, no.
Oh, okay.
I knew I wanted to live there. I didn't ever want to leave. I remember when our first stay was up and we stayed for 10 days, which was quite long back then. Yep. Most people didn't stay more than 2-3 nights. We were there 10. And it was only the Magic Kingdom to do. So we did as many rides as we could several times and had the best time in the world. And when it was time to leave, I was brokenhearted. And I remember standing on the fire escape just outside of the room. Our first room was on the 10th floor. It was 4624. The first two numbers together, 4 and 6, add up to 10, which means 10th floor. And it was 4624, which was the furthest end of the Bayside going to the north. And I went out on the fire escape stairway to look across at the Magic Kingdom glowing with its lights at night. And I was in tears. Because I didn't want to leave. All I knew is I wanted to live there. Mm. Well, that's, you know, not exactly possible, but that was my dream.
After that first visit then, Randy, how often did your parents take you back to Disney?
We returned absolutely every year. I believe 1 or 2 years we actually went twice. But we were definitely back every year. And with each trip, my affection grew stronger. And of course, we always stayed at the Contemporary. And I remember when they were getting ready to open Epcot for 1982. Wow. How could that be? What they were telling us about it. They were presenting the city of tomorrow under the glass dome, Epcot. I remember when they were promoting that at the Magic Kingdom. It was the old Walt Disney story. They had the Epcot Preview Center, and they were telling us about, you know, what Epcot was going to be. And they showed, they had an architectural map that was gigantic, showing they had the areas below that was going to be the traveling areas for the freight and then the commuting areas all below the ground. And of course they had the green area around the city, which was for the living. And my sister and I both had the area where we were going to live picked out on that map and the little architectural houses. That's where we were going to live. We were going to live in Epcot. We had our mind made up. So, I mean, we were going to egg our parents, you know, onto it because we wanted to live in Epcot. And I remember when Epcot opened, probably that was the first real disappointment for true Disney fans, because we were expecting the Epcot that Walt Disney presented. We were expecting that city to open up under the dome. And, you know, of course, how do you build a dome? Well, that might have been futuristic and quite, you know, the impossible architectural thing. But nobody said when Epcot was opening that it was going to become a World's Fair, which is what it is. And Epcot was called Epcot Center. It wasn't just called Epcot. It was Epcot Center. And it was always related to that way because it was justified by saying, well, Epcot's not done. They're going to continue with Epcot. This is only the beginning, and this is the center.
Right.
It's Epcot Center. Well, as we know, it never grew into the city that was portrayed it to be. And certainly I never got to live in the house that we had picked out, when we were kids. But I did get to be a cast member, and as a cast member, I was there all the time because I was a permanent cast member, and that was about as close to living there as you could be because I was there all the time. And we bought a house that was as close to Disney property as could be at that time, and that is right near the SeaWorld property. There was a housing development over there called Williamsburg, and when you got on the I-4 off the Beeline Expressway, which is 528. They don't even call it the Beeline Expressway anymore, but it's 528 to I-4.
I remember Beeline.
The very next exit took you over to the Lake Buena Vista exit, which is where you would get off and then go up 535 around the backside of Disney property to go up Reams Road to the cast member parking lot behind the Magic Kingdom. So I couldn't have been any closer. There was nothing built at that time. It was all greenery. And it used to take 23 minutes to drive from my driveway to that cast member parking lot. And you could almost time it by a Disney show, which I used to have, shows that I watched while working there at the castle or Tomorrowland stage on a cassette tape. And most shows would run for about 23 minutes. It's kind of their magical time. And I would pop a cassette in when I would be riding home and listen to the show again up until the point that I drove into my driveway.
Randy, when you say we bought the house, oh, Steve's looking at me saying that was my question.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, my mom and dad, of course, financed it. Where would I have the money to buy a house?
Okay. No, I suppose I'm leaning towards what happened to your sister in this? Did she move down with you? Did she work at Disney?
Well, my sister ended up marrying a guy who was in the amusement business, and she ended up living with him and the family, and she lives down in Florida now also. She's down in Pompano. So she went her own way at that point.
Okay. Right.
Oh, no, go ahead. You already stole my question.
Okay. There's question stealing. But, you know, we're jumping ahead a little bit there. We were talking about the early years and the contemporary, and the parks. And we touched on the Fiesta Fun Center, which a lot of people today don't even know what that is. At that time, there was an arcade on the first floor of the contemporary, and it was behind the check-in desk at the first floor. So the first year when the Contemporary opened, the Fiesta Fun Center was quite small. They had a snack area where you could get hot dogs and a little carton of milk and some cookies and chips. And then they had some arcade games. There might have been maybe 10, 12 arcade games. And there was a curtain behind the games. And I remember it struck me odd, like, what's behind that curtain? I remember peeking under it, but you couldn't see anything because it was all dark under there. But the second year, the curtain was gone, and the arcade was much, much larger. And the reason the curtain was there was because they weren't ready to make the arcade that large to begin with. And they had a little movie theater in there where they played nightly a Disney classic film, whether it was, Bedknobs and Broomsticks or Mary Poppins. They always played a film. And I actually never went into the theater to see the film because we didn't have the time to see a film. We were there, to do the parks. And, if we had a few minutes, we played in the arcade. But we didn't have time to watch a film. And interestingly enough, the Magic Kingdom, normal closing hours for the Magic Kingdom were 6 p.m.
Ooh, wow.
That was normal closing time. Anything past 6 p.m. was considered extended hours. So if you were open till 7, that was already extended hours by 1 hour. 8 was 2 extended hours. And they only extended hours during holiday periods. So when you stayed at one of the hotels, typically you would get out of the park at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. You would come back, and everybody would be eating in the hotel. And the lines to get into the restaurants were long. You'd wait an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours just to get a table. That was your day. And, of course, the later part of the day, you would wait for the electrical light parade, the electrical water pageant that would come on Bay Lake behind the Contemporary at 10:05. And you didn't want to miss that. It was the magical electrical water pageant. And at the beginning, there was no electrical light parade at the Magic Kingdom. It didn't exist. That came a couple years afterwards. And then it was only in the summer, because in the summer, they were open late. And if you were open late at Christmas time, they had a Christmas parade. You didn't see the electrical light parade. I myself never saw the electrical light parade until I worked there in the 80s.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. And it was such a wonderful parade. But oddly enough, the electrical water pageant in the beginning had the music that became the electrical light parade on Main Street. The original music, that was the electrical light parade, was the electrical water pageant. When the second, third year came around, they changed the music on the electrical water pageant. And honestly, I didn't like it as much. But we grew accustomed to it. And then when I saw the electrical light parade, there was the music. The electrical water pageant, the wonderful music, it was there. And having worked on Main Street USA for Main Street operations, I got to see the electrical light parade twice nightly every day in the summer. How amazing. And I always had a front row seat because I was doing the parade monitoring. So such an amazing time. You know, when I think back to my blessings of where I was placed for my casting, I was dead center in the middle of the heart of the Magic Kingdom, which is the heart of Walt Disney World. I was on Main Street USA, where everything went on. I could have been in an attraction in another land. I could have been walking a treadmill stuck behind some ride console, but I was Main Street operations. And although we ran the Walt Disney Story, we had the sister department with the steam train, we did the vehicles, we were very, very free on Main Street. We had the run of the street from the time you come in and have your ticket taken at the turnstiles. That's now Main Street operations all the way up to and including Cinderella Castle. We had quite a run. Now, that's not the case today. The castle is not being controlled by Main Street operations anymore. But in my day, it was, which meant we took care of all shows in front of the castle. We took care of all special events because they all took care. They all started on Main Street. Anything that was special was on Main Street. Parade started from Main Street. And if they went in reverse, they ended at Main Street. Fireworks, people were on Main Street. Everything was Main Street. We were the hub. And I did not know, I was told and I learned for fact that when you were selected for Main Street operations, it was a high honor because you were better than being put behind a ride console somewhere. The people who worked on Main Street were typically very well-spoken, articulate, intelligent, able to react to situations and control situations without having to ask anybody. Because we were free to roam the street and we made decisions on the spot, unlike other areas which didn't have such authority. I don't think Main Street has the same authority today. Back in my day, there were off-season 12 permanent Main Street operation hosts, and they were all men. Women were not allowed to be a Main Street operations host. It was out of reach. It was also discriminatory, but that was the way it was.
Right.
The men were control of Main Street. The women were in the shops. And that was the same thing for Jungle Cruise. There were no female cast members. And right. for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, there were no female sub-skippers. So how did they get away with that? You know, in the realm of sexual discrimination, you were being cast for a show. You were playing a part. It would have been out of theme for a female to be running the trolley on turn of the century Main Street. It wasn't done. It's done now.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot has been lost because of that. You know, when you go to Main Street and you get on one of the vehicles and there's a young lady from Main Street who's going to drive you, it's not the same. Yeah, she's doing a fine job. That's fine. She's a person too. But it's not the same theme anymore. It's out of theme. We are turn of the century, 1900s Main Street. Women didn't do that. They were shopkeepers at best. When you go on the Jungle Cruise and you have a girl who's the skipper, it's not the same. Because when you go through the jungle, don't you usually have some guy, young guy, doing the, you know, who's driving your boat? And the submarine, same thing. Well, there isn't any submarine anymore, but it would have been out of theme to have girls as your sub-captain. So Disney was true to the theme. They stayed with the concept of the character. So it became more of a job than it was being cast for a role, probably through force of discrimination laws. They were probably forced to open the doors for that. And today, it's pretty much anything goes. You compare the strict, stringent guidelines for a cast member in the beginning and even into the first 15 years. The short hair, the no facial hair on your, no mustaches, no beards, no long sideburns. Women who couldn't wear eye makeup, no earrings, unless it was a simple one earring that had to be of an approved type. No nail polish, unless it was clear. No lipstick, no dyed hair. It's anything goes now. With the latest key that they added of inclusion, you can have dyed hair, you can have makeup, you can have multiple piercings, tattoos. You never saw a tattoo on a cast member. Mm. Now you can have cast members with tattoos. Cast members who wear shorts now with exposed tattoos. You know, when I was on Main Street, we wore a three-piece suit.
Mm-hmm.
And my shirt was buttoned up to its collar. My tie was on to the top. My sleeves were completely down and buttoned. My vest was buttoned all the way down. And it was always that way. It didn't matter if it was 110. That's where it was. They allowed you to unbutton your sleeves and fold the cuff one fold. That was permitted.
Oh.
My cuffs were never, not once, ever unbuttoned. And we weren't allowed to sweat. I laugh at that one. You weren't allowed to look like you were dying and sweating. You learned not to sweat. Or if you sweated, you sweated inconspicuously. today, I see them walking around with the water bottle attached to their belt. They wear short pants, short sleeves, open collars, no ties, no hat, open vests. And my mouth hangs open. I cannot fathom how things got to such a loose degree. Now, I get it. You're trying to be easier for your employees to work a job. But you were not working a job. You were a utopian in that utopia. You were a cast member. You were special. You created the magic. You created the atmosphere. You created the dreams. Not so much today. I remember when they allowed mustaches. I cannot get used to a cast member with a mustache. I'm sorry. I'm old school. Now there's beards quite prevalent. About 5 years ago, I went through the security check, and as I walked past the island, the corner of my eye caught the security host in the next island with the back of his head with dreadlocks hanging out below his hat. I stopped in my tracks. I turned around. I looked. I had to go over and speak to him. I had to take my picture with him. And he felt uncomfortable. And I said to him, I said, I'm not going to get you in trouble. I said, do they really allow a head full of dreads now? And he says, well, the security is an outside company, doing a contract. I said, maybe so. But you would still be upheld to the Disney standards. And apparently that was fine. He had a head full of dreads. Shocking to me is the only word, shocking. Earth shattering in my world to see that. Am I an extreme? Yes, I am an extreme. But through the discipline of that extreme was the perfect world that I loved. And I still love because I loved it from the beginning.
Right.
I don't know if it would be the same if I started there now. I don't know if I would be the 11-year-old kid that fell in love to such a degree today. I don't think so.
No.
That's a big statement to say. I would still like it. It's still wonderful. It's still better than most places you go. But it is not what it once was.
No.
And I fear we'll never be again. And largely because they've grown too large. They have so many positions they have to fill. The workforce is strained. You can only get so many people to fill these jobs. You also have area growth of many other options for people to work. Sure, the area has grown also with more people working, but the opportunities are vast. Just forget about working at SeaWorld or Universal. There's a million other places, hotels for people to work. And your selection of people who you're going to hire is also no longer the same because the world has changed. I was born in 1960. People had a certain amount of standards, upbringing, manners, intelligence levels, common sense that doesn't exist today. It doesn't exist in the world. Well, real people are hired to be cast members. So if you're hiring them from a workforce of the world today, it's pretty hard to find somebody who's of the caliber or level that I was when I was selected to work on Main Street USA.
Yes.
So it's an unfortunate thing. We've done it to ourselves. The world has been watered down, not just Disney World. The world has been watered down. People don't think for themselves. I see people who have jobs where they're giving spiels at attractions and they can't even speak English, which then turned into a lot of presentations being recorded. When I did steam trains, we had a 12-minute presentation and I spoke nonstop for 12 minutes every round, and you understood every word I said, and it was presented in a way of entertaining, friendly atmosphere. It was a professional presentation. You can't get people to do that today. So for years already, the steam train has had a recorded conductor's presentation. Well, you can actually have music with that, and it can actually be nice, and it can be uniform. But every trip a guest took on a train was different because different conductors had different personalities, had different ways of making their presentation. Just like when you go on a Jungle Cruise, every skipper follows the script, but every skipper is a little different.
Yeah.
So the presentation is different. So you could go on the ride several times and enjoy it every time because it was different. Now you go on the ride, steam trains, and every ride is the same.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said for uniformity, so you don't get a bad ride, but there's no variation. And that's sad because the cast members themselves were the most important part of going to Walt Disney World. They were living the dream. you looked at them in admiration because everybody wished they could too.
Yeah.
And their personalities shined. Not so much anymore.
I don't think people can argue that fact with you, because I think you explained it really well, that, you know, we have lost an era, I think, which how you describe, you know, sort of like driving the omnibus and doing your own little spiel.
Yeah.
You don't have that now. And, you know, for a lot of the people that's going to the parks today wouldn't even know that existed.
Interestingly enough, the omnibus, when I first came as a cast member to Main Street USA, the omnibus wasn't there. Because I started in late 84 and Epcot opened in 82 and they sent the omnibuses from the Magic Kingdom of Walt Disney World and from Disneyland to Epcot to drive around the World Showcase, to be the transportation there, to add the living experience and to give people a lift walking around the large promenade of the World Showcase. So when I came to Main Street, there was no omnibus. There had been before, but there wasn't at that point because they were over at Epcot. Well, they started to bring them back around 86. And I got to drive the omnibus up and down Main Street. And the omnibus had a spiel. The driver had his microphone. And when you got on that bus, you were given a tour. And we pointed out different varieties of stores that were up and down Main Street. We pointed out the things to do, the cinema, the Penny Arcade. We told you about the parades that were upcoming or the shows. We went around the hub in front of the castle. And we would specifically point out as we passed the different bridges going to the different lands and what attractions you would find in those lands as highlights. I rode the omnibus just a few weeks ago while I was down at Walt Disney World.
Huh.
And I was thrilled to ride it because of my history with it. But there was no spiel. And that's the way it's been for the last few years that it has made an appearance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't run regularly anymore. They might give your initial safety spiel when you're getting on about, you know, remain seated and keep your hands, arms, and legs safely inside. They'll give the ending spiel about gather your personal belongings, use the handrails, and watch your step while exiting. But not one word from the time you left from Town Square heading up to Cinderella Castle. Not one store was pointed out. Not one attraction was identified as you were going past the bridges. Silence, except you heard plenty of horn. You heard plenty of bell. To let people know that the omnibus is right behind them and they need to clear out of the way because they can't get through on the street. Now, when I drove the omnibus, I drove it under the most crowded of conditions. I've driven the omnibus on Christmas Day, on 4th of July.
Wow.
The street would be packed. I did it. I made my announcements and I very rarely needed to use the horn. The horn was reserved only if really needed. The bell, occasionally. But you know what the difference was? You heard my spiel. You didn't have to be on the bus to hear what I was saying. My voice filled Main Street because the speakers were loud and filled the area as the bus was coming. You heard the announcements being made as the bus was coming. You didn't have to honk a horn at somebody. They knew the bus was behind them unless they were in an oblivion, and that's when you would use the bell or the horn. But it wasn't necessary. So I videotaped my ride on the bus because I wanted to show people the ride on the bus simply because I was thrilled to be riding on the bus. And one of my Facebook friends, who was a former cast member, and he was quite a special former cast member in respect, he was an artist and a sculptor, and he worked on many projects for attractions at the creations of Walt Disney World. He commented that he was very disturbed by watching that ride. And I knew what he meant. And we had a few comments back and forth. He was disturbed that he felt that the ride was annoying for the guests with the horn and for the guests on the street, that the omnibus was an inconvenience coming down the street. And he's not wrong, because all you heard was constant horn, bell.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. Because there was no spiel.
Got it. That totally makes sense.
It is a different experience. When you rode the omnibus, when I drove it, you got an experience. It was a thrill. When I would go around the circle coming from Cinderella Castle down Main Street, I would enter Town Square Circle, turning from the Emporium, going past the City Hall. The omnibus stop would be over towards where the Hospitality House was and the Walt Disney Store. People would see the omnibus coming, and they would run. I would see them run across the hub circle to the spot where the omnibus would be stopping so that they could take a ride on the omnibus. I didn't see anybody run to get on the omnibus now. The street is only 980 some odd feet from Town Square to Cinderella Castle. You do not need to ride any of the vehicles for transportation purposes to go 980 some odd feet. Why do you then ride the vehicles? Because it is an experience of doing so.
Yep.
The experience has changed. Wow. It is no longer an experience other than maybe, well, I got to ride in the old jitney going down Main Street. Okay. Maybe there's a little bit of talk to the cast member because he's right in your face. But the omnibus, you can't really elbow with the people who are on it because people are on the second level over your head. They're behind you. It's a much larger vehicle. So you connected through the microphone. And mind you, we had to be professional on that microphone. You're broadcasting. You can be heard. Just like I said, you could be heard by everybody on that street. You were heard by everybody on that street. And you knew what you could say and the way you could say it to be a Disney cast member. You sounded like a Disney cast member. Today, I don't think they could do it. It would take extensive training. I think it could be done to a degree. But an interesting thing, and I wrote about this on my return trip, I spoke with a supervisor, manager, whatever they want to call them today, who identified herself as being a high-level supervisor for Main Street. That would mean that she was beyond just Main Street operations. She would also be encompassing guest relations and general event planning and things of this nature, because she was high level, probably tickets also. And in the conversation, I was mentioning to her about the Diamond Horseshoe and how the original show closed in 1986 and what a spectacular show that was. And the people who were the performers, the main cast of that show, who I knew. And her response to me was, I wasn't even born in 1986. Well, it didn't make me feel old at all.
Right.
But it was a revelation. Because what she said with that statement was, she has no clue of what the show was. She never saw it. If you are in a position that you are in charge on a high level of what's going on, and you have no concept of what is supposed to be or what it could be because it once was, you don't think there's anything wrong. So she undoubtedly sees the omnibus going up and down the street, thinks that she's doing a superior job because the omnibus is out there and there were no incidents, because she does not know what the omnibus was. How could she? She wasn't born. So, again, it goes back to what I touched upon with the architecture of the, you know, the contemporary and the timeshare edition with Bay Lake Towers. if you haven't lived the experience, how can you be in charge of altering it or operating it? You have to live the dreams. I have lived the dreams. I'm one of the few that was young enough to have lived the dreams at an early age that I'm still young enough to remember them and to have done something with my life about them. People who were older in positions are gone. And as things changed, the new people came in not knowing any different. Disney is also a very large company. As such, there's the mentality of the Broadway play, how to succeed in business without really trying. And part of that play was about a man who worked for a company for many decades, and he succeeded because he would slip into the meetings with the crowd. He wouldn't come in at the beginning. He wouldn't be the first one walking in. He wouldn't be the last one walking out. He would have to be in the middle of the crowd coming in. He would laugh in the middle when the crowd started laughing at the announcements that were being made by the company's CEO. He wouldn't laugh first. He'd laugh in the middle. He'd stop before everyone else laughed. He was going to be not noticed. That, unfortunately, is a large part of the corporate mentality at Walt Disney World. It has been for a long time. People who are afraid to rock the boat. Because if you stand up for something and make a comment, maybe it will go over well. And suddenly the spotlight is on you and the finger is pointing at you. If you come up with some idea or suggestion and they actually implement it and it doesn't go well, you're the fall guy. You came up with that idea. So particularly when you get on a higher echelon scale, you have people who are the yes men, who don't want to rock the boat, don't want to think outside the box, and are there to please the upper management, who are there with one directive: to maximize profits. And that didn't used to be.
Right.
It was about a man's dream. It wasn't Disney World. It was Walt Disney World. It was about a man. A man, his philosophy, his morals, his dreams. It's become corporate out of necessity. I understand it. There's room for it, but not at the cost of what made Walt Disney World Walt Disney World. They need the icon who is living the dream. Now, Walt Disney never lived to see the opening of Walt Disney World. He died in 66, I believe it was. Disney World opened in 71. He was there for the beginning of the planning, but he never opened. He never lived to see its opening. But he was not gone that long. There were people who worked at Disneyland who were brought over to Walt Disney World, who worked with Walt Disney, who were indoctrinated with those morals, with the philosophy of what Disney is, and they brought it with them. But over the decades, Walt Disney has become only a statue. He has become a poster, an image, but not a real person anymore. There is no one who is the icon of when you go to Walt Disney World, that this is the person in charge. This is the person who is running the park, who is living the dream. Now, I'm in the amusement business still all my life in my own places. What makes my places different is that I am there all the time. I'm there opening to closing 7 days a week. I'm seasonal, so I'm not open 365 days a year. So I have the winters, theoretically, that I'm not doing that. So I'm able to do that. I'm able to recover. But when you come in to my place, I am the icon. I am seen. You know that when you walk into my store, it is not a store that is there primarily only to take your money. You know that I am living my dream and that you are part of the experience. There is a major difference. That is what separated Walt Disney World from Six Flags or any other corporate park in the world. That's why Walt Disney World was the special place. People felt it. People knew they were living an experience from a man's dream and philosophy. Today, many of the executives and managers, they got what was on their resume. They used to work at Six Flags as a manager. Well, you know what? Okay, I get it. They have some experience in theme parks and management. But that's not the level of Walt Disney World management. At least it wasn't in my day. When you went to Six Flags, you went to Six Flags. This is Walt Disney World.
Right.
The admiration of the world. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
I'm 61. If I could have the power to go back and be in a position that I could be a difference and make the differences to bring back the magic, I would, out of the loyalty that I have for the park and the love that still lives within me. I don't believe anyone would ever be given the power and ability to bring that back.
Yeah.
Because it would come at a cost of profit line.
Randy, I mean, I think anyone that's into Disney has Facebook groups they follow. The groups, I'm seeing so much more of frustrations, fighting going on at Disney. I mean, from what you've been sharing with us, this seems to be kind of like the fallout of losing what once was. Is that a fair statement, would you say, or is it?
It's a fallout for sure, but there's other contributing factors. The world has changed. People are not with the same dignity that they once had. When you went to Walt Disney World in my day, when I was a kid, you saw families with grandma and grandpa, and they were dressed in their Sunday clothes, maybe not suits and ties, but wearing right. very nice clothes because they were at Walt Disney World, and ladies carried their pocketbooks, and they had maybe even high heels, or definitely heels anyway. They weren't in flats.
No,
their hair was fixed up. They went to the beauty parlor because they were going on vacation to Walt Disney World. I remember at the Contemporary when we were kids, one time my grandmom was with us because my mom and dad had to go looking for a house. And my grandmother stayed at the Contemporary with us for a couple days while my mom and dad were away. And my grandmother, of course, being even older school than my mom and dad were, was going to be very, very prim and proper. And when we got back from the park to go down to get something to eat, my sister and I put on our Japanese flip-flops to go down, you know, to eat. And my grandmother was mortified. And being kids that we were, you know, we were like, what's wrong? There's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, that's all we had. Is that, you know, so we went down with that flopping along. And when we came back up from dinner, we got out of the elevator. If you know about the Contemporary, you can go one way or the other. It's like a T at that point, or an I, should I say. And my grandmother lost her bearings and started walking the other direction.
Yeah.
And my sister and I are like, Grandma, Grandma, it's this way. And she was going to ignore us because she wasn't talking to us at this time. Because she was so humiliated about us wearing flip-flops that she walked to the opposite end of the building and then realized and had to walk back. But that's the point. Society was different. Society was there to be in a very special place. People take for granted now. We're going to Disney World. Yes, it's special, but you know what? We're not going to dress up for it. We'll wear the T-shirt with you know, a Disney thing on it, but we're not going to wear, you know, a nice shirt with a tie or anything else like that. We're going to Disney World. We want to be comfortable. Well, okay. Then you got the rising prices. And when people are paying more, they expect more. The expectation level becomes higher. And they saved up a lot of money to go on that trip, more so today than ever before. So when something doesn't go right, you have a meltdown because people are so now ready to, you know, go crazy because some little thing didn't go right. So has Disney lost its magic? No, there's still plenty of magic there. It's been watered down. Your guests are more difficult. You have plenty of Karens from the internet who are there looking to make trouble or start a fight with somebody over nothing. But it's not that people didn't get aggravated over small things in my day also. It's just it wasn't frequent. And you certainly didn't hear of a million people complaining about what happened to them at Walt Disney World or complaining about they didn't like this line or that price and this and the other. And Lord knows there's plenty of things you can complain about today with the way that they've created the Fast Pass and now the Genie Pass, making it so that you got to make reservations with everything on the telephone. So, you know, your app on your phone, and everything's got to be so, and you got to have your whole day planned out ahead of time. People like to be somewhat spontaneous. You know, I remember waiting in line an hour and a half or more to go see the Country Bear Jamboree. And I'll tell you something. There was something magical about waiting in line for an attraction at Walt Disney World. The lines always kept moving. You weren't stagnant in a line. When you went to Universal, you were stagnant in a line. But Disney lines moved. Everything was like clockwork. You never really felt like you were standing in line that hour and a half. And you'd start talking with people who were in the line. You'd pass the same family on the other side of the rope this way. You'd have a few words. And then you'd see them again. You'd laugh. Oh, there you are again. You'd start talking again. It was almost part of the experience. Now, with the way it runs, if you're in that standby line, you might as well carry a chair. Because you're stagnant. You're stuck in that position. The queue isn't moving because the line is stopped. Because others are going ahead while your line is stopped.
Right.
Well, from the beginning, when they started FastPass, it wasn't a new idea. It was something they had already started at Six Flags and Premier Parks, where they were selling get in front of the line privilege. So Disney came up with FastPass. And everybody could get three FastPasses. And it was free. I said from the beginning, this is a very bad idea. I said, you're creating two lines. And do you think it's not going to be abused? And I don't mean abused by guests. When you have created two ways to get into the line, suddenly now all guests are no longer equal. Some guests are privileged, some guests are not. So now instead of everybody in the line seeing the length of the line and the line is moving and you're going to get your turn, now you're standing in the line while others are getting ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
The very concept of that is against human nature. So yes, they try to do it a la Disney, putting separations so you couldn't see the other line most of the time. Soarin' is one of the best examples of that. You can't see through the wall. Okay. But you can see the tops of heads passing in reflections. Unless you're an idiot, you know what's going on. So they created the FastPass. Okay. Well, it's still fair and equal because everybody gets three fast passes. But how do you know how somebody gets a fast pass? How do you know that those people got three fast passes like you did? How do you know they don't have unlimited fast passes? How do you know that they didn't get fast passes when you tried to get fast passes and you couldn't, but they could? How do you know privilege wasn't given? Well, many instances privilege is given, but you don't know because, oh, everybody gets three fast passes. So was it free? Not exactly. Because the massive computer that is distributing fast passes, how is it deciding who gets the fast pass? Is it equal? If 100,000 people go on a ride in a day and they decide 50,000 fast passes will be issued and 50,000 people will go on a standby, does everyone have a fair and equal access to those 50,000 slots? Or could it be that 10,000 slots of the 50 is in a separate quorum that's being reserved for resort hotel guests on property, and another 10,000 is for special guests, and maybe another 10,000 for the deluxe most popular suites,
right?
Different tiers and levels. So when you go try to get a fast pass, maybe there's no longer a fast pass available in your group, but others can get access. So is that fair? But you don't know about it. So no longer is it equal. Now you've created separate lines. So are all guests the same? They once were. Of course, there were always VIP tours that got ahead and they came in through the exit. And you could see it. And I also saw on the faces, even when I was a kid, guests standing in line resented when the VIP tour would come to the Jungle Cruise and would get on from the exit and take a boat that they had to wait another boat for.
Yeah.
People are very, very fair by nature. They don't like to be taken advantage of. But FastPass created two lines, so of course, it's there to be abused. So can people be given a complimentary FastPass because, you had a bad day? Let me give you a free FastPass. Oh, the big smile. But what did they give you? They gave you someone else's privilege.
Wow.
Then you create special viewing areas for parades or fireworks. Suddenly, now all the guests are not equal again. Because if you don't have a fast pass for the viewing area for the parade, you can't be in that area. So now you're not the same. I saw one time as a guest after my working at Disney World, Town Square, where on the outside of Town Square, in front of the train station and all around, people were 12 deep, packed in. Little kids had no chance of seeing if they weren't in the front. But the island in the middle had nobody there. A few people here and there, But that was for special viewing. And I saw people who, not knowing that, walked across the street to stand on that side with the other people. And cast members came over and they were told they couldn't stand there and they had to go back. So the kid that was with them had to stand behind the crowd of people that was 12 deep when they could have stood. It was all that extra area that was taken away from regular guests because now these people are special. That's fundamentally wrong. If I was there, that would not be if I had the power to not allow that to be. But apparently nobody but me sees that that is wrong. They see that now we have the ability to give special privilege. Well, how did these people get the special privilege to be there? If you ate at Tony's Town Square Cafe, you got special viewing area for the parade. That's how it was done at that time. I don't know what they're doing now. Really? So now you better eat in the hotel or you better eat at the special restaurant because otherwise you could be in the crowd with the peasants.
Yeah.
You know, it used to bother me and as Main Street operations, we always had to be around when there was a VIP. So if I got sent to monitor an area because there was a VIP coming and they were going to rope off a special area, that used to boil me. That used to anger me. I had to do it. Why did it bother me? Because you're taking areas away from guests for other people who are now special privileged. Okay, I get it. Certain celebrities cannot be in the regular crowd. I get it. But you know what? There's ways of doing that, and there's ways of not doing that. I remember one time where I was sent to Town Square because we were going to have a VIP for the Electrical Light Parade. Now, typically, you would find me at Center Street. I like to be at Center Street because I could respond from one end to the main street pretty easily because I was centrally located. The guys in my department used to mock me and call it Center Street because they knew where I would be. They didn't want to be in the center of things. They wanted to be over in some corner. They didn't want to have to respond. I was in the middle because I wanted to respond. Okay. I get sent over to Town Square to monitor a special position in front of the train station because VIPs are coming. And I'm not even told who. Because it's like on a need-to-know basis. If they told me who, maybe I might tell somebody. Okay. So here we go. It is the middle of the summer. People are 12 deep, and there is a roped-off area with stanchions in front of the train station, right on the sidewalk, prime viewing area that has nobody sitting in it. People are asking me while I'm speaking with guests who are waiting for the parade, who's coming? Who's coming? And I'm playing along with them, and I go, I don't know. Nobody told me. So... 5 minutes before the parade, here comes the VIP guest relations representative with the VIP family. And they get in their positions like royalty. Now people are asking me, who are these people? Who are these people? And I'm going, I don't know. Who are these people? Then I go to the other guests in there. Who are these people? Do you know who are these people? And somebody recognized that it was Tito Jackson and his family.
Oh,
and I go, wow. Oh, it's Tito Jackson and his family. And then I go to the other guests. I go, it's Tito Jackson and his family. Then I go, who's Tito Jackson? So now I walk myself over. And I stand in front of them as they're sitting on the curb. And I'm a couple feet in front of them, and I'm looking down at them. And I don't say anything, and I'm just looking at them. And they're looking up at me, and I go, what did you guys do that they have you all roped off like this, keeping you away from everybody?
Exactly.
And meaning like they're being caged and penalized.
Right.
The guest relation guy puts his hand on his head like, oh no, he's gonna start.
Yeah.
And he was right. So I went on teasing with them, and I told them that they were in luck because I understand that in just a few minutes the world famous Mr. Parade is going to appear right on this street in front of them, and he is going to be giving the pre-parade announcements for the Electrical Light Parade, which will be coming very shortly. And I'm playing it up all the time, knowing I'm Mr. Parade that's going to be doing this.
Right.
Which I used to do twice nightly on Center Street, but it was the perfect area because I had a clear shot visibility of everybody watching me 12 deep as I stood in the center of the street with a completely emptied street as they're waiting for the parade.
Yeah.
And the area sound music would slightly lower and disappear, and then they would start the parade pre-recorded announcements, and I would become Mr. Parade. Having heard it twice nightly every night, I knew it word for word, breath for breath, and I would announce it as if I was giving it. And people wouldn't know if it was really I,
right,
or if it was a recording. And I would have theatrical presentations with my arms and a little look sometimes with a sneer, or possible, is he looking like that was said in disgust? You know, I mean, I did it very, very eloquently. And I don't even know if I still remember it, but it was, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, in just a few minutes, you will be experiencing a unique pageant presented only at the Magic Kingdom of Disneyland, Tokyo Disneyland, and Walt Disney World. the Main Street Electrical Parade. His sparkling fantasy recreates scenes of many of Walt Disney's most memorable film classics in over a half million colorful twinkling lights. Powered entirely by batteries, some of the brilliant parade units measure up to 100 feet in height and 1/4 mile in length. I messed that one up. Through the magic of light and sound, you will relive Alice in Wonderland and attend Cinderella's Ball. You'll see many members of the famous Disney character family, including Goofy, the Seven Dwarfs, and of course, Mickey and Minnie Mouse. In order for you to fully experience our parade, the Magic Kingdom area lighting will be reduced. We recommend, for your own safety and convenience, that you enjoy our parade performance by remaining in one location until the lighting returns to normal. We hope you enjoy the unusual sparkling fantasy of the Main Street Electrical Parade beginning in just a few minutes. Thank you. I left out the part about all the electro-symphonic musical sounds.
Oh, but anyway, yeah. Well, that's, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Pretty good for a memory from 35 years ago. But I'll tell you.
Yeah. Randy.
When I would do Mr. Parade, I would have thunderous applause. Everybody ate it up and loved it. But I was doing something that was unheard of. I was mocking a Disney presentation in the middle of Main Street, USA. How could that possibly be? Unbeknownst to me, I had been given the grace to do Mr. Parade. They were aware that I did it. Disney's not stupid. They know what's going on. But they were getting a free show by a professional twice nightly who wasn't getting paid to do it. One time a new guy came on Main Street and he saw me doing Mr. Parade and he thought it was the most fantastic thing in the world and he had to learn that spiel. And one day when he learned it, he tried it and he did it at Town Square while I was doing it over at Center Street. And he was pulled off the street right after that and he was told if he ever tries Mr. Parade again, he will be off property before the parade ends. That quote unquote, Randy is the only one allowed to do Mr. Parade. So it was known to higher authority there that I had a special way about me. Guests loved me. They loved me because the guests loved me. It was a magical time.
Yeah.
So after Mr. Parade was over, Tito Jackson's kids are calling me over, They want to take their picture with me.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, okay. I'm like, you know, and I wave my hands like, all right, like pointing the ways. I'm like, make room. And I make scoot over and I climb over the rope and I sit on them. And so they take the picture. So that day, oddly enough, I happened to have had a 35 millimeter camera in my weather gear utility pouch that was strapped to my belt underneath my coat jacket. Because I wanted to take some pictures of some friends who were leaving that, their college program, whatever was over, and I was going to take some pictures earlier. So using the opportunity, I says, wait a minute. You think you're the only one who likes pictures? And I pull out the camera. Oh, you don't do that as a Disney cast member. I said, you thought we had really important stuff in that gear pouch, didn't you? And I pull out the camera. Yeah. Now, I climb over the rope and I get a guest from the other side to come over and stand there and take the camera and take the pictures. I climb back over the rope and I sit on them again and we pose and get my picture with Tito Jackson and his family.
Wow.
Randy, that's an amazing story. And
I've got lots of them. But
oh, I know.
The parade goes on. Now, here's the cherry on the top of this one. The next day, I'm back over at Center Street, do my Mr. Parade over there. The parade ends, and I'm grabbing up the ropes from my area at the back of the parade. And usually at the end of the parade, there's a draping rope being carried by some cast members, and usually following along are some upper management in suits and ties that are walking at the back of the parade, like to monitor the area, like, you know, isn't it wonderful that we did the parade? So here I am, and I'm wrapping up the rope, and the parade is just exiting as I'm going, and I hear some screaming. And I turn around because the screaming is people mad. And they're coming over at me. And who is it? It's Tito Jackson and his family. And they spot me and they come over and they're pissed. And I'm like, what happened? What happened? And I'm watching. I see the two area managers are walking with their heads all turned, looking at me like, what's happened? What happened with Tito Jackson? What's going on? What's going on? They had such a good time the night before. They made Disney set it up again the next night so they could come back and see Mr. Parade, and I wasn't there.
You weren't there.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
They said, did you do Mr. Parade over here? I says, yes, I always do it over here. We were over there waiting for you. And I said, I'm sorry, nobody told me. I pointed over at the two managers who were looking with horror. And I said, it's their fault. Yeah. I said, you see that right there? I said, you go tell them to set that up again tomorrow.
Oh, I love it.
And they couldn't because they had to be in Vegas for some show the next day. Whatever. Right. So that's the kind of fun. People loved it. People, why? Because I lived the dream. I was the icon. I had the personality. I was there with the guests doing the thing. I, for all intent and purposes, was Walt Disney. I was living the experience, and people loved it. You don't have it today. I don't know if Disney today would ever have given me the carte blanche to do what I did. And that's just one example. One time, we were in our meeting area. They called it the bomb shelter because it was built like a bomb shelter from the heaviness of the train station. It was an office down there.
Yeah. Randy.
Yep.
This show tonight, we want to end with the Tito. Okay.
Okay.
I can't wait to hear all these other stories.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm still waiting for what I see as the best bit is what you're doing today, because, you know, I've got Disney, I've got history, and what you're going to share with us on what you're doing today stems from your childhood from 1972, playing at the Fiesta Fun Center, to driving the omnibus. We've got all these stories to look forward to where you are today. Time has just slipped away from us. I cannot believe how fast it's gone. We're going to end the show, this show, now, but we're going to pick it up on another episode. Randy, I can't thank you enough for giving up your time this evening. It's just been so magical.
Well, it's been a pleasure and an honor to speak about these stories. And I hope all your listeners really enjoyed them as much as I enjoy telling them. And it's important for people to understand, because the older people know, the younger people don't. Maybe they have now a little better insight, and there's more to come.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Randy. We'll be in touch and we'll get episode 2 out. So until then, thank you very much, listeners, for being part of the show by listening to us. And you know where to find us. We'll talk real soon. Take care, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks, folks. Be sure to gather all your personal belongings and watch your head and step while exiting.
Perfect.
Good night, Randy.
Bye now.
Stars glow for you. Go see the world, cause it's all so brand new. Don't close your eyes, cause your future's ready to shine. It's just a matter of time before we learn how to fly. Welcome to the rhythm of the night. There's something in the air you can't deny.
And thank you!